from KCPW in Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. With its wide streets and large lots, Salt Lake City is in many ways Brigham Young's grand experiment in city planning. But no matter the original plan, buildings and neighborhoods and transit routes change with the times. What was once a home is now a boutique. A train depot becomes transformed into a shopping center. But still, those original elements continue to have a lasting effect on the look and feel of a city. Urban planning scholar Brenda Shear studies how cities evolve, and today on the program she joins us to describe why cities and buildings and roadways change, but also how past shapes future. Plus, the enduring appeal of silent movies. We'll have a chat with the owner as well as the acclaimed organist of the Organ Loft. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Take the long view of a city, and you may focus on the things that have changed. The buildings that were demolished, the office buildings that replaced apartments, the emergence of strip malls. But you can also see glimmers of the city's original plan, and how certain elements have stayed intact. Urban planning scholar Brenda Shear asks, how do buildings, patterns of streets, and other urban elements shape and limit a city? Today on the program, we're talking about how cities evolve, and Brenda Shear is with me. She is the Dean of the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah. She's also an accomplished author, her latest book is titled The Evolution of Urban Form. She's the past recipient of the prestigious honor of a Loeb Fellow at Harvard Graduate School of Design, and she's a registered architect and a certified planner. Brenda Shear joins me in studio, and Dean Shear, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Brenda Shear will present The Evolution of Urban Form, a lecture as part of the Making Good Cities lecture series. That's happening tomorrow night at 5 o'clock at the Leonardo, 209 East 5th South, here in Salt Lake City. The lecture is free and open to the public. And for more information, you can go to our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, why we still love silent movies. We'll have a conversation with Larry Bray and Blaine Gale from the Organ Loft. But first, urban evolution. How has your neighborhood changed? What would you like to see in the Salt Lake City, the Sandy, the West Valley of the future? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dean Shear, in his State of the City address yesterday, Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker said, we're in the midst of a renaissance here in Salt Lake City, a return to walkable neighborhoods, a new performing arts center, the City Creek development, et cetera, et cetera. As an architect and a planner, would you agree with Becker's assessment that this really is a Salt Lake City renaissance?
I do believe in that, and especially with the kinds of things that you're seeing downtown with higher density and the new City Creek Center. I think that you will see a lot more people, especially in the traditional, the older parts of the city, taking advantage of a city that was really built in the 19th century and under traditional kinds of forms. So taking advantage of those forms is part of Salt Lake's legacy, and we can actually, I think we're beginning to see a lot more investment in things that are more traditionally urban.
I definitely want to dig into Salt Lake City's past, because it's a very interesting past from a planning perspective. But just generally, is there such a thing as an ideal city? And as a planner and an architect, what does livability mean?
Well, actually, an ideal city, there's a lot of different visions of what an ideal city might be. But I think a lot of people who are planners really like to think of an ideal city as a place where people can be the kind of people they want to be and have the kind of relationships they want to have. So it's not necessarily a physical form. Every time we set out to build an ideal city architecturally, we fail. So, and one of the lessons that I like to say is that we basically create cities by building them slowly over time and accreting them in a way that we don't recognize too often, instead of sort of building it all at one time. And so an ideal city is the one where people can change it to be what they want when they need to.
for millennia, people have flocked to the cities and formed cities because they were centers of commerce or religion or government. Do cities today serve that same those same functions?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, cities are, by and large, the greatest generators of economic activity in the world. And if you look at the largest cities in the United States, that's where, even though they only take up a small fraction of the land area, it's where most of the people live, and it's also where almost all of the economic activity happens. So they're great generators of activity and economic activity.
Mm-hmm. You think of Paris, you think of Rome, even Salt Lake City and the skyline that has unique features. Cities can be so different in their look and feel, but are there some common threads in the way that cities change and develop, you know, sorts of patterns?
Yeah, there are. And, you know, different cities around the world have grown differently because they were created at different times. So a city like Paris or London, there were seeds of those developments from Roman times, actually. So they're ancient cities in a way, especially a place like London, which has an ancient which was founded by the Romans. Mm-hmm. So there are ancient cities that have grown over time and changed over time and developed over time and become really interesting because of these little micro changes that happen all the time. And then there are the newer American cities. I mean, some American cities like Salt Lake are, you know, only less than 200 years old, and yet they're still important places, Los Angeles, for example. And this sort of age of the city is kind of an important feature of why, how it's different, how it's formed.
We're speaking with Brenda Shear. She is Dean of the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah, author of the book, The Evolution of Urban Form, and she'll be speaking as part of the Making Good Cities lecture series tomorrow night at 5 o'clock at the Leonardo here on Library Square. The lecture is free and open to the public. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. As you mentioned, you know, some cities grow organically out of some sort of ancient settlements. Others, like Salt Lake, were laid out in a very deliberate way. Let's talk about Salt Lake City. It was platted out by Brigham Young. What can you tell us about Young's original vision for this area?
Well, it's very interesting because Brigham Young was using a plat that originated with Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith is actually the planner of Salt Lake City, of course, although he died many years before Salt Lake was founded. When Brigham Young came here, he had in his hands the plat of Zion, which was Joseph Smith's idea about an ideal city. And that plat formed the basis of what Brigham Young laid out. So the size of the blocks, the width of the streets, the size of the grid, even the temple location and the sort of center of the temple were ideas that came from the plat of Zion.
Okay.
So lots of people say, oh, well, you know, we have these wide streets because Brigham Young wanted, you know, there to be, you could turn a horse ox cart around in the middle of the street and make a U-turn.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it's much more profound than that because it's actually the width of the streets were given to Joseph Smith as a revelation. So this is not, you know, this is kind of a holy city plan in a way that's not kind of practically based as you would think with an oxen U-turn, but it's actually a kind of impractical plan on a lot of levels.
Mm-hmm. Did Joseph Smith had some input, even though he wasn't here physically. Did the vision extend further out into the Salt Lake Valley, or was it really just, you know, this is a blessed site and it will have walls around it?
Actually did have walls around it at one time. In fact, Salt Lake is one of the very few cities in the United States that had a wall. And
where was the wall? Do we have remnants of the wall?
I don't know that there are any remnants. It was around 13th South. So there were, it's a very, you know, unusual kind of story, and I'm not sure why the wall was built, but it was only there for a few years, and it occupied a number of young men, and I think that these were men that needed some occupation, so it was kind of a public works project. But I think that Salt Lake was, the city was intended to be a fairly large city of about 40, 45,000 people. But it wasn't intended to extend way out into the valley. Brigham Young liked to found new towns and new villages, and so he would sort of deputize a few families as they moved in, as they came to Salt Lake or immigrated to Salt Lake through Immigration Canyon. They could hang out for a few months, or, and then he would send them out to found a new city. And he founded over 300 cities this way.
300 cities.
300, well, we would call them little towns.
Settlements.
Now, a few blocks, settlements, and so forth. Some of them grew into large cities, like Mesa, Arizona. And some of them, you know, stayed pretty small, like Manti.
That's really interesting to have that kind of a reach. Do you think that was intentional on his part?
Oh, yeah. I think that there was a very strong intention of the church to have a long sort of series of settlements stretching from Idaho down to the California coast. And that was a kind of way of creating their own sort of land of Zion, where they could gather people, where the settlements would then have all of the faithful sort of gathered in from the world in these settlements.
You mentioned that the wide streets are not necessarily practical, and yet here we are. They dominate this city. They dominate the surrounding communities out into the burbs. Why does this stay when we know that it's not terribly practical?
And you know, when you think about it, imagine the same streets, muddy, really wide, horse-drawn carriages dropping you know what all over the place in the 19th century. I mean, if they were impractical now, they were terribly impractical in the 19th century. And yet, they were built over and over and over and extended out. And I don't know why they did this. When the Mormons built Nauvoo, they didn't build the streets and the blocks like in these dimensions. They built them in the exact dimensions that the avenues is built, which is kind of interesting. But so they had some experience building a city before they came to Salt Lake, but here they decided to really go with the official approved plat of Zion, and that was the width of the streets of the plat of Zion.
We're talking with Brenda Shear, Dean of the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah. She's presenting the lecture, The Evolution of Urban Form, part of the Making Good Cities lecture series, and that is happening tomorrow night at 5 o'clock at the Leonardo here on Library Square. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. We're talking about the evolution of the urban core, and how do you feel about how Salt Lake City is evolving, other surrounding areas in the Salt Lake Valley? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Each city has a unique character, but all urban areas shift and change with the times. What gives rise to certain types of buildings, and why did city founders lay out a city the way they did? What effect has a grid system had on this region's long-term growth and development? Today on the program, we're talking about how cities grow and change, but also how they stay the same. With us this hour, Brandi Shear. She is the Dean of the College of Architecture and Planning Planning at the University of Utah, also author of the book, The Evolution of Urban Form, and she'll be giving a lecture tomorrow at 5 o'clock at the Leonardo. More information on that as we go. But if you'd like to join the program, if you have questions or comments about Salt Lake City's skyline or about smart growth trends, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dean Scheer, one thing that really has changed the landscape here and throughout the country and throughout the world, I suppose, is the advent of the car. Cars really had a direct and lasting influence on the way cities and towns have developed. Talk a little bit about the role that a car-centric culture has on planning and development.
Well, when we built most older cities like Paris or London or even Salt Lake, they were built with the idea that people would mostly walk. Mm-hmm. So once you were living in a place, you would walk to the store or walk to with your work. And that was extremely common. When people started to have streetcars and then even more to drive, they expanded outside of the crowded city. So housing developments began to be built on the edges of cities. And these are really common to us now. We think of them as sort of natural. These areas, even places like Sugar House and so forth, waited until the car really became part of our culture. And so it kind of did away with the old grid form. The grids no longer were really helpful as a way of structuring space in the city. When you have a car, you can drive as far as you like and plop down anywhere you like. When you have a car, you can drive to a Walmart or you don't have to take a little walk to the corner store. And so the corner store kind of dried up under that scenario. And places like Walmart also became inevitable because of the global sort of economy. They were able to import goods and things from all over the world at very cheap prices, which your corner store didn't really have access to those distribution systems. So this really changed the way our urban fabric is, because with big box stores and strip shopping centers and big, large, central, these were not really very comfortable places to live next door to. So you now had a big separation of uses. Instead of having the store on the corner around the block from where you could send your kids to go get some candy, now, you know, you had a giant big box store. You wouldn't want your kids anywhere near that or near the giant arterial road that serves it. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different urban fabric.
There is a, I don't know if it's a nostalgia, but there is a movement to return to the corner shop and this, you know, walkable community that we hear Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker talking about.
Right.
Is that kind of orientation even possible in a place like West Valley or Draper, where things are very spread out and they have been from the beginning? Can a grassroots effort to restore a walkable neighborhood even possible?
You have to remember that we have to live with whatever the people before us gave us. They gave us a system of streets. Brigham Young and the early pioneers gave us the grid that we live in with downtown. We can't really change that. It's just almost impossible to change it. And so in a place like Draper or West Valley City, the only way to sort of create a walkable place is to actually create it out of like an old shopping center or a large piece of land that people have. And to sort of then turn around and create a traditional urban fabric, which is a small walkable grid. And that's really difficult to do, because normally these old grids were embedded in older gridded neighborhoods too. So they weren't you know, sort of insto small town, it's really difficult.
I know that West Valley is making efforts in this regard. And I'm also thinking of the new City Creek development that will be opening in Salt Lake City, I guess in a month and a half or so. It's a development that is touted as very multidimensional. It'll have residential elements to it. And they've also tried to carve up these very large blocks to make them more friendly to pedestrians. Will it work?
I think absolutely it'll work. But City Creek is not, it's not an old city that was evolved. City Creek is a whole brand new contemporary shopping center with housing and movies and restaurants and so forth in it. I think it's going to be extremely successful. But it's going to be successful on the terms of being a brand new, you know, built all at once center. And over time, it's what we kind of have to think about. So what happens in 50 years to that place? It's going to be successful here for the next 25 years for sure. But just like the things that preceded it, the shopping centers that were there before, things get obsolete. And so, you know, I think about, well, what's going to happen, you know, in the future. But for right now, it's going to be a very walkable, very pedestrian-friendly, but very contemporary place. It's not a piece of an old city like a piece of Paris or a piece of London.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, not necessarily. It's what we can build right now. We actually, you know, we have to live with it. Like I said, we have to live with the grid we've got. One of the fortunate things is that we do have these huge blocks. And so you're able to take two blocks, as the church has done, and create, you know, this whole brand new development, which I think will be very exciting.
Another thing that we're seeing, not only here in Salt Lake City, but in some of the outlying areas, is buildings transitioning from one use into another. I'm thinking of the train depot at the Gateway, or there's numerous shops in Midvale that have transformed former industrial buildings into retail stores. Right. How are buildings reused, and are they being reused, or is the trend to tear things down and build something new?
Well, it's very interesting because I think the theory is from urban planners and architects is that if a building seems valuable to a culture, if we think there's something about the building that is important to us, then we'll keep it, like the train stations, and or like the city county building right here. So those buildings become revered things, and we will reuse them and adapt them. And some buildings are very adaptable. Other buildings are very, very precisely built, like a hospital, for a particular use at a particular time, and those buildings are the ones that are more likely to be torn down. So a really flexible building is going to be useful. Even like an old big box store can be made into something else, like a school, and these things have happened all over the place. And yet that's not a revered building type. It's just that it's a big enclosed space that somebody needs to use.
It's a practical use of that.
Right, right.
But sometimes I would say that, you know, cities or counties, the regulations there stand in the way of reusing some of these buildings. You know, who wants to transform an old gas station into a house? And are those codes useful? Are they appropriate? Are they needed?
A lot of cities in the Salt Lake Valley, and there are a lot of them, a lot of jurisdictions are looking at changing their regulations so there can be more flexible uses, so that people can have the kind of pedestrian places they'd like to have, which really, for codes 10 years ago, just were not possible in some cases. You had to have, you know, something separated by by a lot. So you couldn't have a nice corner store in a neighborhood.
Mm. We're speaking with Brenda Scheer, Dean of the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah, author of the book, The Evolution of Urban Form. And you can join us if you'd like, 801-355-TALK. If you have questions or comments about the evolution of your neighborhood, give us a call, 801-355-8255. This email from Mark, who writes, I'm wondering if you can have Brenda Scheer address the effects of urban form that the return of a streetcar system will have on Salt Lake City's urban evolution. How will the new streetcar connections impact densities in Sugar House and South Salt Lake? And how will its effect differ in downtown Salt Lake City, which is also looking to introduce a streetcar connection to the track system? Brenda Scheer?
The only way that a traditional city can be revived, its traditional form, is if we have a transit system that serves it. And so we're already seeing the expansion of tracks all over the valley, and the more it expands, the more people will use it. And the streetcar is the same sort of situation. The more it's an expansion of the public transportation system, so that the more and in other places, that's had a huge effect on the development of a neighborhood over time. It's really encouraged development to happen. It does take time. It takes, it's not going to happen overnight. And it also takes demand. So if there's not demand for that kind of housing or whatever around those, then it still won't happen. But I think in Salt Lake, there is demand. There is going to be success with the new streetcar. There will be new developments that occur already. People are already talking about these things around track stations and around streetcar stations, stops.
Mark, thanks for the email. It's funny, though. I mean, it almost seems like Back to the Future. There were trolleys that ran up and down South Temple and other places throughout Salt Lake City, and then they were torn apart, and here we are again 100 years later.
Right. In fact, we had more train tracks around the turn of the century than we do now. So and we were able to go more places. Just about every street, 2nd South, 1st South, 3rd South, had a streetcar line on it. And this is the way people got around for a couple of decades. And then, like you said, things were torn up.
So are the trends cyclical in some ways? Or, are they just that, trendy or fashionable, and then they go out of favor?
You know, I think we're trending back to reappreciating what we lost. When we started having strip shopping malls and even big mall, interior malls, we lost a sense of community that comes from living in close proximity to each other and sharing schools and sharing stores and having the local restaurants and so forth be something that we could all be close to. And so I think people sort of mourn the loss of that. They live in areas where, you know, the only restaurant is some chain restaurant that's, you know, not very tasty, and nobody knows their name, and the only stores that are available are large chain boxes. And so it's people sort of miss that sense of belonging to a smaller community, or even belonging to a city that has a very distinct look and feel to it. So I think that's what we're really trying to bring back, in a way. Not so much that we want to live in certain densities or with certain look, but we want a sense of community we don't have.
The sense of community that we've been talking about is centers on buildings and on thoroughfares, but maybe could you describe or discuss the role that open space plays in a city's evolution? I mean, how important are those open spaces to a sense of community, as you say?
Well, you know, cities built in the United States in the 19th century didn't really have very much open space. They were kind of afterthoughts. So a place like Central Park, for example, you know, emerged about 75 years after the grid of Manhattan was laid down.
And so did they just tear out buildings?
No, it just was unbuilt. Mm. And it was unbuildable because it was full of rocks. So out big, big, big rocks.
So it was convenient to have an open space
there. It was convenient to have an open space there. They said, let's have a big park, and they built it. And that was one of Frederick Law Olmsted's ideas. He actually had the idea to build this huge park there. And, you know, waterfronts and other places we would think of as natural park areas, they were working parts of the city. They were very important working parts of the city. So open spaces were kind of rare. And up until the park movement really began in the middle of the 19th century, and it didn't really pick up steam until later. So we think of open spaces as being very important, but in cities were small, and if people wanted to get out and be green, they just took a walk. Out to the countryside.
It didn't take long, huh?
No, it didn't take very long. So, you know, when things got, you know, spread out, way spread out, then I think we had the sense that we really lost the ability to be very close to nature. Nature's really important to humans. It's really a revival of a human spirit. And so for people today, they're really into, I think it's really important to have parks and open spaces really integrated with the city, or fingers of parks like City Creek Park that come right down into the middle of the city are really of an advantage.
One of the points that Mayor Becker made in his remarks yesterday, the State of the City address, he talked about perhaps some integration of the development along the Jordan River. How can that be accomplished in a sustainable way? You know, keeping the river corridor pristine and yet accessible.
Well, I think the biggest problem there is not the actual physical plan, which we've already imagined. Envision Utah has imagined a really wonderful, system of parks and open spaces. So some part of it is open spaces, and some places are very accessible to people, especially around key intersections, and a lot of places are brought back to their natural state, so the stream bed can have a regular flow to it that was more natural than it is now. So it's not so much imagining that. The problem is that there's like 30 jurisdictions, different cities and towns that control their part of that river. And so really the big problem now is to create some kind of entity, which has been created, the Jordan River Authority, to help control what happens there. So it's not just, you know, Sandy versus West Valley City versus, you know, any other number of versus Salt Lake City, so everybody can kind of start to agree on what needs to happen.
So there's coordination along the entire corridor.
Not just coordination, but it's how do we fund it? How do we fund those improvements so that they're an advantage for the entire region, the entire county? So is it fair just because a tiny city has a long river corridor that they have to pay for everything in their bit? Mm. So there's some sort of sense of fairness about those questions too.
Brenda Shear, our time is short, but your latest book is titled The Evolution of Urban Form. Why is it important to understand how cities evolve and change?
I think that if planners go forward and they just apply sort of formulas that they think are good cities, they're oftentimes going to fail because they don't take into account, as I said before, the place that we have, what we've inherited from our forefathers and foremothers, is the place we have to deal with. We can't change many things about the city. We can't change the site of Salt Lake City. We can't change the grid structure of it. It's just too difficult. It's too ingrained in what we do. And so if a planner or anyone doesn't really understand that evolution, how it came to be, and what constrains it to the future, it makes it very difficult to plan a new future.
Brenda Shear, she is Dean of the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah. Her latest book, The Evolution of Urban Form, and she'll be speaking on that topic as part of the Making Good Cities lecture series. That is happening tomorrow, Thursday, January 19th at 5 o'clock at the Leonardo here on Library Square. The lecture is free and open to the public. And Dean Shear, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Up next, the enduring appeal of silent movies. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today's box office blockbusters often showcase fantastic special effects and lifelike computer animation to tell stories. But one of the films in Oscar contention this year has none of that, and in fact pays homage to the earliest version of the art form, the silent film. One Salt Lake City establishment has been showing silent movies for decades, and joining me now to talk about why silent film continues to enthrall audiences, Larry Bray. He began working for his organ collecting uncle, Lawrence Bray, when he was just 13, repairing old organ parts in the chicken coop where the organs were kept. Since his uncle's death nearly 30 years ago, Larry Bray has worked to establish the Organ Loft as a hub of old style Americana. And Larry Bray, thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Blaine Gale. He started studying piano at the age of 7 and for years was employed as a musician, demonstrating electronic organs and keyboards for dealers. Gale fell in love with the theater organ in the 1960s, and he's worked playing the Organ Loft's prized Wurlitzer for over 30 years now. And Blaine Gale, thanks very much to you for your time.
And thank you.
If you have questions about silent movies or Buster Keaton or the mighty Wurlitzer at the Organ Loft, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. As I mentioned, one of the contenders in this year's Academy Awards is The Artist. It's a French film that is a silent movie. Another film last year, Hugo, is really a love letter to silent movies. Why do you think people still love silent movies, and why this recent interest in silent film? Larry Bray?
I think it's because it has so many aspects to it. You've got nostalgia, you've got history, you've got entertainment with live accompaniment on the theater organ, and then you have the audience participation, you know, which makes a big difference when you have a great comedy showing and everybody gets involved. It just brings the house down.
You inherited the Organ Loft in some ways.
Yes, I did.
But why do you stay in the business? Why do you love it so much?
Well, the instrument itself is beautiful. I mean, if nobody's ever heard a theater organ, it's quite an instrument. And we also do private parties and dinner banquets. And so I enjoy working with my hands and doing stuff like that. And well, I've been there 36 years, so.
So you must love it.
Yep.
Blaine Gale, why do you think people go to the silent movies? Why do they still love it?
There's an experience involved in a silent movie where we're all sitting together, responding together, and we give each other permission, so to speak, how to respond to what we're seeing. And I think that's the big draw why people come to the silent films, and it's the thing that inspires what I do. It gives me the clues of what I can get away with. It's a conversation.
Of course, a central component to the silent film is the music that you play, Blaine Gale. Reflects the mood of a scene being acted out. It adds some comic elements or whatever. The Organ Loft has a very unique instrument, the mighty Wurlitzer. Tell us about this instrument, the organ at the Organ Loft. Larry Bray?
Well, they were actually created to accompany silent movies. You know, they originally had pianos or an orchestra, and it was so expensive to do something like that that a gentleman named Robert Hope Jones decided to create a unit orchestral, and that basically is a theater pipe organ, so one person could do all the sound effects. It has everything from bells, whistles, horns, to marimba harps, xylophones, sleigh bells. So anything that they need to portray on the silver screen, a theater pipe organ can do.
Huh. Blaine Gale, can you remember the first time you played the Wurlitzer at the Organ Loft?
Oh, I don't think I can, because there are so many and so far back. I have to jokingly respond to people, say, what was your favorite piece of music or your favorite movie? And I'll say, tell me, what was your favorite breath? And I'll then tell you.
Well, give us a sense. I mean, I don't play the organ. So what is it like to be at that keyboard and to have so many different sounds at your disposal?
That instrument literally has enough to draw from. that it drags it out of an artist or a musician. And I refer to it then as a nirvana, a top of all of the musical instruments, because there's so much available for you to use to describe emotions and to describe everything being depicted on a screen.
It's very different experience, I imagine, from playing the piano.
It is. It is.
In what way?
Well, in the biggest sense, there all the parts of music have to do with the volume and the control of it. And in piano, it's the amount of touch, how hard you hit the key. For that thing, not only does it have the various voices, but it also has expression pedals that opens up the shutters. So we have the wide variety of what is happening in a real orchestra. That's why it was referred to as a unit orchestra, as Larry said.
How old is the organ at the Organ Loft, Larry Gray?
The majority of this instrument was probably built around 1928. It came out of Staten Island, New York, out of the Paramount Theater. So all your big lavish theaters had these installed in them, and then when the talkies came in, a lot of them just went by the wayside, and my uncle was so intrigued with the sound, he decided to get one and preserve it, and that's how it all started.
I want to play a clip of the organ at the Organ Loft. This was recorded in 1960. The organist is Gus Farney, and this is a familiar tune. I imagine many people will recognize it, but let's take a listen, and then I'll have you respond to it. Of course, the classic Singing in the Rain, recorded in 1960 on the organ at the Organ Loft. Has the sound of the organ changed since 1960? Blaine Gale?
Oh, I would imagine each organ has its capacities based on the number of voices it has and how the room is. The best stop or voice selection on the organ is the room that it's in. And in our case, we have a very lovely, close-in, intimate sound that's different from a huge, echoey theater. But, oh, it's a pleasure to hear and to feel.
Larry Bray, this has your toes tapping, your head nodding.
Yeah, I'm
you
familiar
love this
with
music.
That. Yeah. Yeah, I grew up listening to a lot of this stuff just because we've had so many organists that have come through. They all have their own style of playing and stuff, and so it's a lot of fun to listen to people's different styles.
We're speaking with Larry Bray. He is, would I say, a co-owner? An owner?
I am the owner,
The owner of the Organ Loft in Salt Lake City, also with this organist, Blaine Gale. We're talking about the enduring appeal of silent film. If you have a favorite silent film star or a favorite memory at the Organ Loft, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Now, this weekend, you're showing The Cameraman, starring Buster Keaton, as part of your winter silent film series. Larry Bray, tell us about this film, the plot line, and what to look for in Keaton's role.
Well, Buster Keaton was one of the big comedians. Most anything that he did is right on the top. And The Cameraman is one of his better movies. And we have two gentlemen that work with us, Hunter Hill and Richard Hill, that collect all the movies, and they know everything about all the silent movies. So it's something we're seeing.
Are the films that you show, are they still on the old reel-to-reel, or are they digitized now?
We did start out 22 years ago showing the 35-millimeter and 16-millimeter stuff, but then as technology advanced, they started remastering onto digital, and we use mostly DVDs now because the quality is so much better, and they've taken different clips from the same movies that they have put together to get the best that they can, you know.
Buster Keaton, one of the greats of silent film, what is his appeal? He's known as a comedian, but there's much more depth to him as an actor.
Very much so. He's so funny just to watch because, for one thing, they all do their own stunts. It's just like Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, they all do their own stunts. And it's amazing to watch him because it's not trick photography. And so that in itself right there is just a real thrill watch what they do.
he got his start in the business at a very early age. His parents, I understand, were vaudevillians. And he's known for this deadpan expression on his face. Blaine, do you think he is a comedian, or is he just a master actor, or what is he?
Yes, most definitely. And the contrast of that great stone face of his and the things that he goes through amplifies some of the things that he's doing. And in so doing, it amplifies in my mind and in my fingers how to express that and how to share that with the audience. And the audience laughter at the appropriate places. And combining all of these things is just like that actor himself, his great stone face and yet his amazing stunts.
Yeah, he has quite a range. Blaine Gale, when you are playing along with a film, a silent movie, do you watch the film?
Oh, yes.
How do you do that and keep all your hands and feet going at the same time?
Well, the first thing is being so well acquainted with the instrument itself, where the controls are and where everything is, and your fingers automatically march across the keys. So I don't have to watch the machine. I'm watching the movie. That's my music, so to speak. And
so you're not using sheet music?
Oh, no. I take the music rack off or I wouldn't be able to see the full screen.
I want to play another clip. This is actually a recording from last November. This is you, Blaine Gale, on the keyboard. And you are accompanying, this is Keaton Knight. So this is a Buster Keaton Knight at the Loft last November. Let's take a listen, and then I'd love to hear your impressions. Now we can hear some laughter. This is a live recording of the audience. And in some ways, the silent film is so interactive. It relies on the audience response. Blaine Gale, when you're playing and you hear that kind of laughter, how do you respond as an organist?
Oh, it's the language itself. Music is the language we're all able to understand so clearly. And for me to be able to hear the laughter, I can respond using the language of music with my fingers instead of whistling or humming.
Let's take another listen. Melodramatic there, Larry Bray. is that part of the beauty of the silent film, the music that goes along with it?
I think also the audience that goes along with it, too, because we get a lot of different variations of age. You know, generally it's middle-aged to older, but we've been seeing a lot more 20s, 30s, bringing their families to enjoy this art form.
So why the recent interest, do you think, in this art form? It really is a very unique art form. Why do you think people are returning to the silent film in the way that we are?
Well, one, for the fact that we've been doing it for 22 years, so it's kind of been out there a little bit. The other fact is that I think good things just have a way of circling around and getting back to you, you know. There's a lot of people that are interested in, like I say, history and nostalgia and stuff like that. And there's a lot of good movies out there. I mean, if you go on the top 100 on the internet of best movies ever, you'll see four or five silent movies right there. You know, Charlie Chaplin, The Gold Rush, and Sunrise. There's just several of them out there. And great directors, D.W. Griffith and Who's the other ones?
Well, the Access.
Cecil B. DeMille's, yeah.
Access has never been better. I mean, you can just download something right on the internet and take a watch. But what is the appeal of being there in the theater with a group of people and, of course, the mighty Wurlitzer?
There's no comparison at all between sitting on the couch with a bowl of popcorn and watching and hearing exactly the same thing. That which others next to you go through gives you permission to respond, and in fact, it's building us ourselves in what we appreciate one with another.
Blaine Gale, he is one of the organists at the Organ Loft. And Blaine Gale, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Also, Larry Bray, the owner of the Organ Loft. And the Edison Street Organ Loft continues its winter silent movie series with a screening of The Cameraman, starring Buster Keaton. That is this weekend, tomorrow and Friday night, 7:30 at the Edison Street address. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. Larry Bray, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Jesse Ellis is our technical director. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley. You can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Remembering how the civil rights movement played out here in Utah, tune in for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.